The Market Musings Podcast. Well, hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast here from Stockbox, where today we're joined by Cedric Simonet, of course, the CEO of Altona Rare Earths. And Alan Green is joining as co-host on the podcast today. But Cedric, welcome back. It's been I know we did a podcast with you quite a while ago, but it's good to be catching up again. How are things?
Thank you, Mark. I am good. Thank you. How about you?
Yes, very well. Very good. Thank you, Cedric. And Alan, how are things with you?
Yes, very good. Thanks, Mark. Very good. Another fine day here in Sussex. It looks like summer might be finally arriving. So hopeful anyway.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. And Cedric, where are you at the minute? Where are you calling from?
I'm in Maputo.
In Maputo. Okay. And what's the weather like there?
Maputo. Yeah. It's hot. Today's hot.
It's hot. Good, 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 good. Well, it's cold where I am. I'm in the Netherlands. Yeah, I don't know why, but it's chilly.
It's cold and sunny here, so we'll dream of that, Cedric.
Yeah,
sounds
indeed.
Great.
Well, it's nice to have you on the podcast, like I say, Cedric. I know we would have done one quite a while ago, probably. We would have gone quite deep into your background and where you've come from. But I wonder if we can perhaps just start off with that a little bit, just briefly, your career history, particularly with the natural resources space. I wonder if you can perhaps just give us a potted history of Cedric Simonet, and then we can talk about how it's worked up to Altona Rare Earths.
All right. Well, how can I summarize this? I'm a geologist. I hold a PhD in geology from the University of Nantes. I've been doing economic geology all my life and managing mineral exploration or mineral-linked businesses during all this time. So I've done most of my career in Africa. I started in a ruby mine, gemstone mine, which is still located in southeastern Kenya. I spent 5 years there, and it was very interesting because it was a small operation. So as a geologist and then as a manager of a mine, I had the opportunity to really learn all the angles of mining, not just geology, but also actual mining, operating mining equipment, marketing the products, and so on. At some point in my career, I moved back to France for a few years, and I landed a very, very interesting job, which was to work on one of the last operating mines in France. Okay. And actually the last mine operating in France back in 2006. So that was a fluorspar mine. And this fluorspar mine, we had two open pits and one underground mine and two processing plants, a flotation plant and a gravity separation plant. So I was in charge of the open pits as mine manager, and I was also in charge of all the geological aspects of the business, and also in terms of environment, I was in charge of water treatment and water monitoring. So it was a very, very interesting job. Unfortunately, at the time, we were getting to the end of this exploitation because that mine had been producing fluorspar for about 50 years, and we just had exhausted the ore body. There was nothing else to mine, so we had to close, not because we are not profitable, but because there was nothing left to mine. After that, I did a short stint at the alumina refinery as a Lean Six Sigma black belt. I was trained while I was working at this fluorspar mine. I spent about a year at this alumina refinery in southern France, processing bauxite, turning it into alumina. And I decided to move back to Africa because I thought that Africa had more opportunities, business opportunities in terms of mining. And I worked for several different companies. I worked for an exploration company, a Swedish exploration company called IGA Resources, which at the time had some projects in different parts of Africa. So I was in charge of gold exploration in Kenya, in charge of vanadium, gold, and tantalum exploration in Burundi. And after I finished working for this company in 2009, I decided to go self-employed, and I set up a geological services and drilling services company in Kenya. It was called Akili Mineral Services. It's not anymore in action. And we provided services for about 90 or 100 clients in total. It was quite a nice thing. After that, I worked a little bit in the energy sector, coal seam gas in Mozambique. That's when I went for the first time in Mozambique. And later on, I met with Christian Taylor Wilkinson, who was at the time the CEO of Altona. At the time, Altona was transiting from its coal assets in Australia to a rare earth strategy. So I started to get involved with Altona when the company was building its portfolio. We looked at several different projects in Malawi, in Uganda, also in Zambia. And we decided to settle on the Monte Muambe project in Mozambique. I was then appointed COO of the company. And I think you know the rest of the story. We've done quite a lot of work developing Monte Muambe. And when Altona got listed on the main market in June last year, I was appointed CEO of the company, which is my current position. Now, to summarize, one of the things I like with my career and which is very useful for me as a business manager and especially now as an executive on a listed company is that I've touched many different commodities in different jurisdictions, and I've had many different types of jobs around the mining cycle. So I have a very good understanding of the mining cycle. And when I look at a project, I don't just look at how big a resource we can produce or what grade we can get to. I look at the whole cycle up to construction and operation, marketing, commercial aspects.
Well, there's a couple of things that I want to pick up on. So really, you are originally French, aren't you?
That's right.
But you spent most of your career in Africa, and this is because, well, you say because you feel there's lots of opportunity there in Africa. I guess you also like the sort of way of life, the country maybe as well?
Yeah, this is correct. I like the way of life. People in Africa are very friendly, and they have a beautiful culture. Which is quite important to me. And as long as you respect the law, you can do pretty much what you want. Nobody is going to try to stop you. Of course, you respect the law, you respect the people, but you can do what you want. And to me, that's great. You don't have some of the barriers that you would find in Europe.
Yeah, okay. That makes a lot of sense as well. You know, we, of course, the barriers or the hurdles that you might have in perhaps more developed nations, they're perhaps stifling growth or opportunity. I mean, when you talk about opportunity in Africa as a whole, I wonder if you can say what you see there in terms of Africa's perhaps role Africa will play in delivering or providing the base metals, the commodities that the world is going to demand in the future?
Well, I think it stems largely from the geology of the continent. The geology of Africa is fantastic. And some parts of Africa have been very well explored and are very well known, but most of the continent exploration is still in its infancy. Especially for important commodities such as critical raw materials, critical metals, rare earths, lithium, graphite. This is all relatively new, and exploration for these commodities has been happening mostly over the last 10 to 20 years. So there is a lot which has not been discovered in Africa, and this is the first thing. I think that the second opportunity, which is already quite important and which is going to become more important in the future, is that traditionally, Africa has been seen as a source of raw materials. Very little processing or value addition was done for many mines in Africa. And raw ore or concentrate was exported. Now, in the framework of this green energy transition, this is changing. And not only do the African governments put in place new legislations which oblige mining companies to try to consider doing more value addition in country, but also there are actually opportunities to do this which can benefit the companies, the shareholders of the companies, our investors. So I think it's a very important angle. The opportunity in Africa is not only about mining and extracting raw material, it's also about processing these raw materials in Africa.
Yes, that's very important. I mean, do you feel that, I wonder why Africa is just underexplored? Is it just because developed nations were able to develop their natural resources just quicker, and now perhaps, you know, those kind of resources, I mean, Australia, maybe setting aside Australia, also Canada, there's still lots of opportunities in Canada, but compared to the more developed nations, Africa's just been historically underexplored, has it? So there's opportunity there, and it requires just, well, I don't know, Western interest or governments that are on board. What's driving the sort of future in Africa? Is it purely from most of the deposits that we know in the West are drying up and we need to go somewhere, or is Africa opening up more?
I think that it depends on the minerals. There are some minerals which are found everywhere in the world, but mostly in Africa, like, for example, cobalt. So the situation as far as cobalt is concerned is a bit different.
Purely but geographical.
You are talking, yes, yes. So you were talking about Western interest being a driver for more investment in Africa. I don't think this is entirely true. Of course, Western interest is important, but there is also an increasing local interest. And this is creating a more advanced, more mature mining industry in many countries of Africa. And this is quite important because it helps developing things. It helps making discoveries that can then attract foreign investment if necessary, but also local investment. So there is a sort of buildup of this mining industry, of this mining culture in many African countries at the moment. We see that a lot in countries like Zambia, like Kenya, like Tanzania. And I think that this is very positive.
Cedric, a question from me here. Looking now at the Monte Moeri project, of course, you've established a maiden JORC mineral resource estimate of 13.6 million tonnes at 2.42% total rare earth oxides. But interestingly, you talked about that diversity of mineralization across Africa and why Africa is so in demand. Of course, Monte Moeri was previously a fluor spar mine, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. That's quite interesting. Carbonatites, which are the geological formations that often contain rare earths, also contain other minerals, including fluor spar. There is actually a fluor spar mine in Namibia, which is hosted in a carbonatite body.
Yep.
That was the case for Monte Moambe. It was seen as a fluor spar deposit. In 2012, there is a company that was operating there, which defined a resource, a fluor spar resource for Monte Moambe. But that resource was a little bit small, so Monte Moambe cannot be considered as a standalone fluor spar deposit. However, now, looking at it under the angle of rare earths, from what we've done with our scoping study, we estimate that the average fluor spar grade of the ore that we would extract and process for rare earths would contain about 15% fluor spar. Okay. So since we are going to extract this ore, put it through a mill, and then put it through a flotation plant, it's completely worth trying to see if we can also extract this first part and have a byproduct, which would then increase the revenue of the operation.
Excellent. And of course, I think the fluorspar market has been fairly benign, hasn't it? But that's a real added value for Monte Muambi that I don't think, perhaps the market is as aware of as it could be.
The fluorspar market has been improving a lot from the time I was involved in it 20 years ago. The prices have increased almost fourfold since then. So it's definitely a good value proposition for Monte Muambi.
Excellent. Okay.
And I mean, I was just going to talk a bit about the opportunity in the Monte Muambi there, because of course you had the scoping study. It came out last October, I think, didn't it? October 2023. Yep. Yeah. And I mean, that scoping study, of course, the scoping study is almost the first study, if you like, of during a mining company's development, and you go into to DFS, and then of course bankable feasibility. But I mean, as a first pass at looking at the project, I mean, the numbers are pretty impressive, aren't they? I mean, there's a post-tax MPV there of $283 million, payback in 2.5 years time, an 18-year life of mine, and a capex there of $276 million. So, I mean, the numbers look nice, don't they? I mean, obviously, it's a lot of money to get it going. But, I mean, in terms of that first pass, looking at the scoping study, Cedric, how does it make you feel, really, about the prospects of that project going forward?
It made us feel very good because the numbers are robust, and they completely back our decision to go into the pre-feasibility study.
Mm.
But one thing that we learned with rare earths is that you have to deal with a situation where you have long-term fundamentals for the rare earth market, which are very, very solid, driven by the green energy transition. But at the same time, it's an emerging market. It's a niche commodity. So the price of commodities is going a little bit up and down. We had a bull market for neodymium and praseodymium towards the second part of 2021 up to the beginning of 2022. And since then, the rare earth prices have been falling. So we need to look at the sensitivity of the project with respect to rare earth prices, and to improve the resilience of the project to rare earth price fluctuations, what we need to do is to improve the economics of the project. And one way to do this, which is very important for us, and this is what we are focusing on, is the metallurgy. We currently have about 100 kilo of ore from Monte Muambi, which is being tested in SGS Lakefields laboratory in Canada. And we have another sample which is undergoing a similar process in Australia. And what we expect from this is an increase in the grade of the concentrate. So to put this into context, the extraction of rare earths at Monte Muambi in the scoping study, we considered three steps. First, mining the ore. Second, taking the ore to a beneficiation plant, which includes crushing, milling, and flotation. And this process produces a concentrate of bastnaesite, which is a rare earth mineral. And then this concentrate is taken to a plant which will be just next to the first one, which is a hydrometallurgy plant. And that concentrate will be leached, and rare earths will be extracted and reprecipitated in something we call a mixed rare earth carbonate. Now, the hydrometallurgy part of the whole project is the most expensive, both in terms of capex and in terms of opex. The opex for the metallurgy is 55% of the cost of the project. So in the scoping study, we took an assumption that the concentrate from the first plant would have a grade of 10%, because we were not able to do at the time as much metallurgy as we wanted. But we know that it's possible to do bastnaesite concentrates over 20%. And this is now what we are doing with the current metallurgical testing. We are expecting that we will be able to produce a concentrate of 20% TREO or more. And what that means, if you put into the hydrometallurgy plant a product which is twice more concentrated, which has got twice more rare earths, for the same output, the costs of the hydrometallurgy are going to be divided by two. So more than a quarter of the OPEX of Monte Muambe would be removed just by the results of this metallurgical testing.
That's a really, really strong argument there, Cedric. I mean, you know, you're halving the, well, you're doubling the quality of the end product, and of course with First Bar in the mix as well, halving your OPEX cost, which is that's very impressive, and particularly given, as you said, you know, the rare earth prices have come back. But of course, we're seeing a real focus on rare earths now, certainly in the London market. We had European Green Transition IPO on the London market last week. Shares IPO'd at 10p, now trading at 12.5p. And of course, they have the Ohlsson Rare Earths project in Sweden, which I don't believe is as advanced as the Monte Muambe project. So, and of course, Ursula von der Leyen, the EU president, said that rare earths are going to be more important than oil and gas, and the demand in Europe certainly alone will increase fivefold by 2030. So that puts Monte Muambe in an exceptionally strong position.
Absolutely. The difficulty that we have with rare earth projects at the moment, and it's not only us, it's most rare earth companies, And when I say most rare earth companies, there are about close to, I believe, 300 rare earth projects, non-Chinese rare earth projects on the planet at the moment. Yet there are very, very few actual operating mines, so lots of projects. The problem that we have at the moment with funding rare earth projects is that because the price of rare earths has been dropping over the past almost 2 years, there is a bit of a lack of interest in investing in rare earths. Yet, the short-term price of rare earths for a project like Monte Muambe, which still has to go through PFS, BFS, front-end engineering and design and financing, so we are talking 4 years at least before it gets into production. The rare earth prices, the current rare earth prices, is not very relevant to our project. Only the long-term rare earth prices is. But that's not the way investors look at junior exploration companies involved in rare earths. So when you have a rare earth project, but the rare earth price is down, it makes it more difficult to fund that project. That's one of the big difficulties for rare earth companies at the moment.
And I mean, on the rare earth sort of market then, let's say, I mean, first of all, it's not quoted sort of like the price of gold or copper, for example, is it? There's no sort of spot price, or is there?
No, there is no spot price. When you see reports on prices evolutions, these are Chinese domestic prices.
Right.
That is the only reference available.
In terms of sort of that, I don't know, the market or how it's performed in the past and how perhaps it could perform in the future. I mean, it's a new market, a bit like the lithium market, really. And actually, you could probably argue the graphite as well, because graphite was never interesting, but it makes up 40% to 50% of lithium ion battery. So these sort of, they're not new. They've been around since, you know, the Earth was formed or what have you. But in terms of a commercial use for them, they are new commodities. So what I understand from lithium, for example, from a lithium sort of supply and pricing point of view, the supply side is quite lumpy. You know, the pipeline, you get sudden big supply, oversupply of it, big lumps come down, and then it kind of dries up again. And that's what's been making the lithium price fairly volatile. And predictions are that will continue before it sort of stabilizes out. Would you say it's a similar thing for the prices of rare earths here? That it's still very much finding its feet. It's still got to be understood. Perhaps even new markets have to be developed. I mean, I don't even know if on the London Metals Exchange, you know, if they are if they are bargaining for rare earths. I'm not sure. I mean, what is the state of the market, in your opinion? How far does it have to go to perhaps be as commonly known as the price of copper, for example?
Yeah, it will take a long time. Right now, the rare earth market is dominated by China, both in terms of production and in terms of consumption, at least on the upstream part of the value chain. So for this to change, it will take some time. Right now, as I said, there are several hundred rare earth projects being looked at all over the world, and very few of these projects will actually go into production for different reasons. It can be technical issues, it can be grade issues, it can be jurisdiction issues, regulatory issues, and so on. At the same time, there is also a market which is being developed for intermediate companies on the value chain, refineries, separation plants, because when you produce a mixed rare earth carbonate, as its name says, it's still mixed. You still have the all 15 elements together in the same product, so they need to be separated. There are many steps before you get to the actual parts that will fit in a wind turbine or in an electric vehicle. When you talk to people interested in building a refinery, they would like to make sure they are going to have a supply of concentrate or another product to put in their refinery. When you talk to a miner, they would like to know there will be an output for their product. They will be able to sell it somewhere. So there's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, but there are projects at different levels that are advancing in parallel. I don't believe that Western markets, or better say, rest of the world markets, will become completely separated from China. I think the rest of the world markets will develop, but they will remain integrated with China. It's not going to be a clear-cut separation between the two.
Well, China have been sort of slowly building a sort of empire, haven't they, really, through various, cornering the market in terms of supply of lots of these commodities here. But, I mean, what would... Of course, you're working on the metallurgy at the moment, and that's very important for Monte Mwambe here to understand more of the economics of the project here. And we expect to see that. I think that's coming fairly soon, isn't it? You're hoping, I would sort of say, perhaps during the summer you might hope to get that back, would you, Cedric?
Yeah, I think that we'll have the metallurgical results within the next couple of months. We will have them bits by bits because it's an iterative process. Yeah. So we'll get first detailed mineralogy, then we will get the first rougher tests, and so on. So it will be step by step. There will be not just one piece of news, but several following each other.
And I know this will
get about the progress.
Following on from that, you will then look to do further drilling, which will then start feeding into the, is it the pre-feasibility study that will come next?
Yeah. So the metallurgy work that we are doing is already part of the pre-feasibility study. The other current activity with Monte Mwambe is progressing the the mining license application, which we lodged in December. So both the metallurgy and the mining license will help de-risking the project at different levels. And then we will work on the remaining activities of the pre-feasibility study. So there are many things. There are some environmental angles. There are some, obviously, mining engineering and plant engineering angles, also commercial. But a big chunk of that is going to be to drill, to do infill drilling, to increase the level of confidence of our resource. As you know, we already have about 60% of our resource statement, which is in the indicated category, because we tried to drill, to use the resources we had to drill and produce a very solid resource statement. So it's not there is some inferred category resources, but most of it is in the indicated category, which can be converted into an ore reserve, of course, on the back of a feasibility study. So what we want to do is to improve the level of confidence to indicated and measured for the whole resource. We also want to increase a little bit the size of the resource statement to somewhere between 20 and 30 million tons, because that will allow us to have more, I would say, choice between the ore that we can extract. What you see when you do the metallurgy, you do it on an average samples, but in real life, you might find that the ore is a little bit different on one side, a little bit different on the other side. So you must be able to manage this, and you might have to choose certain portions of the deposit as a priority against other portions. So it's better if you work on a slightly larger resource.
Okay. Well, I know we're going to talk about the other projects in a moment. Just to perhaps finish off on Monte Muambe and the rare earths here, you said that with the current sort of rare earth prices, it's not perhaps that easy to raise capital, but that, you know, the prediction is that prices will only increase as the world demands more of these rare earth elements. But I mean, that initial scoping study there, and of course these numbers will change as you go down the different studies route, but the initial capex of $276 million, of course that is a large amount of money that will at some point have to be raised, or maybe you would do you know, a joint venture, or however you decide to progress forward with the project here. But what do you think you need to see in order to perhaps raise that money? Does it purely come down to rare earth prices? I mean, what idea, in an ideal world, what would you like to see by the point that you need to perhaps be raising that? You've made the decision to go ahead and you need to raise that money. What's an ideal sort of global scenario in your eyes?
What I think is that presently, rare earth projects which are at the level where we are, which is roughly the pre-feasibility study or a little bit before, are very difficult to finance on the stock markets, right? As I mentioned, as you might have seen on some of the RNSCs, we have had the US government express a lot of interest in the Monte Muambe project. I've met with several agencies of the US government about this, but they can come in only at the feasibility study level, not the pre-feasibility study. And you've mentioned the CapEx. For a quality project, there are different investment funds, especially green energy transition investment funds, that can support putting together this sort of CapEx. So right now, the concern is to raise money to do this PFS. And we don't think that the stock market is the right solution at the moment. So we are actively seeking a strategic investor to come in into Monte Muambe, someone who is involved already in the value chain for rare earths, that might be on the upstream or that might be on the downstream, someone who is producing electric vehicles or magnets for wind turbines and who wants to secure a responsible source of rare earths. This is a sort of parties we are talking to. We have signed already NDAs. We are working on this very keenly. And by doing this, what I want to do is to be able to fund Monte Muambe separately from the stock market without having to raise funds for this particular project.
Okay. On the stock market. Okay. Excellent. Well, that's nice to hear, and it's fantastic to hear about the interest in the US government. You've already had that interest coming in, but they want to wait a bit longer. That does make me feel good that, I mean, the United States won't, when they want to do something, they will go and do it. And if they see that, they're losing out to the likes of China in terms of securing some of these critical minerals and metals, they're going to go and change that problem. And it seems like they're already starting to do that. So that's really nice. Thank you for that little insight there into what might be to come. And I'm looking forward to seeing how the strategic financing options work out. But I know there's other projects as well that Altona recently diversified. And Alan, I know you're keen to talk about the other projects as well, the copper project. So I'll let you sort of lead this bit, if that's all right.
Yes, of course, Mark. Cedric, just interesting to hear about the US government interest there. Of course, the company I spoke about on the research talks last weekend, Glencore Resources, have a a graphite project in Uganda, and the U.S. Development Finance Corporation, which is an arm of the U.S. government, have basically provided $5 million worth of funding. So, as you say, Mark, you know, the U.S. government, when it gets involved, it will get involved. So that could be very encouraging longer term for Monte Muambe. But certainly moving on to the copper now. So, of course, we're all aware of where the copper price is going. You know, we've got really $10,000 a ton in prospect now. You know, there's an article at the end of last month in mining.com, copper bulls bring back $10,000 per ton forecast for copper. And I think there is a supply squeeze. There's no doubt about it. So, of course, you'll move into both Zambia and the Kalahari Copper Belt in Botswana is extremely timely. Can you tell us a bit more about perhaps the copper project in Zambia, please, Cedric? I mean, it's in the Mufumbe district, and of course, a number of other companies operating there. You've got just to the north of you, I believe, the First Quantum Minerals, the Sentinel Copper Mine, which I think produced somewhere in the region of 215,000 tons of copper last year. So presumably, this is very much sort of in your thinking as you take Altona forward.
Yes, absolutely. So maybe I can come back a little bit on the reason why a company called Altona Rare Earths is now investing into copper projects. I've explained what's happening with the current price of rare earths and how this is short term, but this is impacting the capacity of junior companies to finance rare earth projects. So for me, it was important to diversify the portfolio of projects of the company in a very realistic manner. And we wanted to stay in the critical raw material sectors because we know it well through rare earths. A lot of the fundamentals for other critical raw materials are the same as for rare earths, that is the green energy transition. And that is the case also in a large extent for copper. And so we looked at which commodities we would like to get involved into. We narrowed down on three, which are copper, lithium, and niobium. And then we looked at what sort of projects we would like to acquire. And we decided to narrow down on projects with a relatively low entry cost, using as less cash as possible. Cash is scarce, so we must make the best possible use of our resources to get value for our shareholders. Mm-hmm. And we looked at projects where the initial work required would also not cost too much until the point where we get good news flow. So these are mostly grassroots projects. But we looked also at the quality of the project. We looked for projects where the existing indications were very potential. And the last thing is that we looked for projects in jurisdictions which are ranked as highly favorable for mining investment in Africa. And both Zambia and Botswana fit this criteria. Zambia is among the best, and Botswana is actually the best in Africa, and is even top 10 on the Fraser Institute report for 2022, top 10 in the world, together with North American and Australian jurisdictions. So the first acquisition we did was a copper project. Copper is going into a bull market, and I don't need to explain this in details. There is a chronic undersupply of concentrate, which is happening now and which is going to worsen over the next few years. There has been a lot of news, like the ones you've quoted about this. But I would say when I started to look at this portfolio expansion and diversification strategy, what interested me with copper is that it was a more mature market than rare earth, so it would kind of balance the niche characteristics of the rare earth market. And copper was relatively stable. Now we are getting, as we do these acquisitions, as we implement this strategy, we are getting into a bull market. It's even better for us. We are just at the right time, at the right place. So the Zambia project The license is about 600 square kilometers. And it's a license that used to belong to a company called Freeport McMoRan. Freeport was involved in some large copper mines in Zambia, and they had also a few exploration assets. Then back around 2020, Freeport took a strategic decision to exit Zambia. So they divested from their large mining projects. And of course, they were not going to keep a team in Zambia just for one exploration license. So they also dropped it. And this is a project we have acquired. And because there has been some exploration, we already have a good idea of the geology. So we know that the right geological formations are there. We know that the contact zones between sandstone and siltstone. And you will hear me repeat this about the Kalahari Copper Belt because it's a bit the same situation. We know that these contacts are passing through the licenses. We know that we have geophysical anomalies that indicate some potential mineralization. And we also have geochemical anomalies in the same area where the geophysical anomalies are. So it's a very interesting project. It's grassroots. And what you can expect us to do on this project over the next few months is to reprocess the magnetometer survey data and to do infill soil geochemical sampling to narrow down on these anomalies, on these existing anomalies, and define drilling targets. So it's a very exciting project.
Excellent. So of course, in the Kalahari Copper Belt in Botswana, that's the latest development and the latest project acquisition. Of course, many successful operators and mines in this region too. We spoke last week, Cedric. I mentioned Kavango Resources, of course, operating in the region, and and of course with this with this particular project, you've got a surface area of I believe 270 square kilometers, and there are some zones. I believe looking at the map here, you've got the Banana Zone, Basito Group, and the Khoemacau Zone, all of which have already sort of throwing out decent grades, and Sasana is, as I can see, adjacent to those particular projects.
Yeah, this is correct. So I was on site about a week ago at the Sasana project. I visited the site, and to get there, I drove through the Khoemacau Boseto copper concentrator, and then through the on the side of the Khoemacau Zone 5 underground mine, which was opened in 2021. So we are really in a zone where there has been already copper discoveries, and some of these copper discoveries have already been put into production. We are just 25 kilometers away from Khoemacau. We are 10 kilometers away from where Arc Mineral is drilling and or is going to drill, don't remember. And we are just next to Galileo. So we are in a very, very good area. But more importantly, this project, I like it. It's not just about mineralogy. Again, I'm a geologist. So the Kalahari Copper Belt has been explored for a relatively short time compared to the Central Africa Copper Belt, which passes through DRC and Zambia. And one of the reasons for that is that you don't have a lot of outcrops in the Kalahari Copper Belt. There is a sand cover, which is several tens of meters thick, which covers outcrops, and that has made the life of early explorers very difficult. Mm-hmm. But now with modern geophysical and geochemical surveying methods and data processing methods, it's actually possible to see exactly what's happening under this sand cover. So there is a regional airborne geophysical survey which was flown over the whole Kalahari Copper Belt on the Botswana side. And this survey shows features that allow to pinpoint the location of the rock formations which carry the copper and silver mineralization. So there are two formations. One is called the Dikar formation. It's made of reduced siltstones. And the other one is the Nguakopan formation. It's made of oxidized sandstone. And you can see there is a contrast between the two. There is a contrast in terms of lithology, and there is a contrast in terms of oxidation state. And this is a perfect spot for copper to precipitate, copper carried by hydrothermal brines to precipitate. And this is exactly what is happening along the Kalahari copper belt. This geology, the geological controls of the copper mineralization, are very constant and homogeneous all along the belt. So the contact between these two formations can be seen on interpretation maps from the airborne geophysics. And when you look at the position of this contact, it's repeated several times across the belt because of folding. And you can see that this contact is passing through the Cesana project. We've got about 13 kilometers long of contact inside the license. So we already know we are at the right spot.
That's excellent. So I suppose if an investor is looking at this and looking at the two project acquisitions you've made, would they perhaps take the view, so Zambia's more established, the African copper belt is long established, so that's, in a sense, a safer play, whereas we all know the success that companies are having in Botswana, but is Botswana slightly more speculative, or do you personally view both these projects having equal potential?
I see Botswana as being a younger exploration destination, a younger copper province than the Central Africa copper belt. Even today, over 100 years after the exploration in the Central Africa copper belt started, there are still discoveries. So being in Zambia is good, and the country is very mature. But on the other side, the way I see it is that the Kalahari copper belt offers the potential that a new play has. It has been explored for only a few years, and already there are operating mines which have been opened. And these mines are producing very nicely. The Khoemacau mine is producing 60,000 tons per year of copper and about 2 million ounces of silver. And they have plans to double their production. And these are mines which are low cost, high grade. So they are very good assets. And so for me, the Kalahari copper belt being in its infancy, it's not that it makes it speculative, it's that it provides opportunities to rapidly make discoveries, the controls of mineralization, and the way you can find them in the Kalahari copper belt is well understood. So I'm particularly excited personally about Botswana. And in terms of operating in Botswana, again, it's considered as the best mining jurisdiction in Africa.
Sure. So I guess if Cesana grades really prove up rapidly, then there might be an opportunity to work with the companies operating Khoemacau and so on to fast track the project, or maybe bring them in as partners. That's pure speculation on my part, of course, but that's what you must be thinking.
Yes, absolutely. But what I believe is that by the time we do a discovery and have a resource, there will be even more players in the Kalahari copper belt. There might be even more options to ship concentrate to smelt more smelters. So right now it's not very relevant to us, but definitely in a year or two, it's going to be important to be next to operating mines.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you for that, Patrick. Mark, do you have any questions for Cedric rather on the copper project?
No, I think that covers it, really. I mean, as I said before on an interview, it's good that you managed to actually secure some land in that KCB area, because it is very active, and given, of course, the forward-looking demand and pricing for copper. It's good you managed to get hold of that. I mean, I think, is it fair to say, Cedric, that you've got Monte Muambe? Of course, that's going on with the metallurgy work, but you want to look for strategic financing to take that project further. You will, of course, keep putting efforts into that project. It's going to be the flagship project, but anything you do sort of on the stock market will be, in terms of sort of capital raisings, et cetera, money's raised through the normal market means, they will be put towards the two copper projects. Is that how it's going to sort of look like?
Yeah, we have a very clear strategy with respect to Monte Muambe, which is to de-risk on these two aspects, the metallurgy and the mining concession. And this is what we are doing with the resources we have. And we will look for a strategic investor so that this project doesn't weigh on the other projects in the near future. And as far as doing the acquisitions on these two projects, and as far as starting grassroots exploration, we are also covering this already for the Botswana and the Zambia project. Mm-hmm. So, in terms of operations, the Botswana project is going to receive a lot of our focus right now over the next few months.
So in terms of the next few months then, what are the sort of plans to be active on the ground perhaps? Or what are you looking to do exploration-wise?
Yeah, so on the Botswana project, on the Zambia project, there is a bit of desktop work to reprocess the data.
Okay.
But on the Botswana project, we are going to do underground geophysics. Okay. And we are going to do, so there might be different methods involved, including induced polarization, mm-hmm. and possibly high resolution magnetics. In terms of geochemistry, we are going to do ionic leach surveys. And so ionic leach is a method that allows you to find the real trace elements in the ground. And that allows you to pinpoint copper mineralization under the sand cover and through the sand cover. So it's a very useful method. And these two inputs, the geophysics and the geochemistry, are going to give us drilling targets. If everything goes right, I want to be drilling at Sesana before the end of this year. So that's my big objective.
Okay. So, good. Well, we can look forward to hopefully a few months, maybe summer of news from Altona here, which is nice. I just want to finish off just briefly. You mentioned it right at the start, Cedric, about the mining cycle and how you understand that going through your whole career here. And yes, we hear about the mining cycle. There'll be some people in the market. I mean, I've been investing in miners since about 2013, and even then there was people who are very well respected saying that the boom time is coming, and we saw a little bit of that maybe in 17, 18 perhaps in the miners. But I mean, where do you think we are in a sort of mining and commodities cycle? I mean, you've got gold at the minute, obviously all-time highs, which is obviously good to see that commodity going up, but that then maybe suggests that there's wider concerns about geopolitical things or the wider stock market. But sticking strictly to the mining sector, the mining cycle, where do you think perhaps we are in the curve, and how many sort of years do you see the mining sector being sort of hot?
I think, there has been a recent bull market around 2021 and beginning of 2022. It was short-lived. The increase was very steep and the decrease was also very steep. I think at the current commodity prices, they are all quite close to bottom. And that's true also for rare earths, but also in particular for lithium, for some other metals.
Mm.
So I think that from where we are now, the trend is going to be upwards. Some metals are going to pick up and stabilize, especially these critical raw materials like lithium. I think lithium is going to pick up and stabilize, not really another bull market, but the price is going back up and kind of stabilizing market becomes more mature. Copper, as we've seen, is going into a bull market. To me, that seems evident. I will not comment about price predictions. But definitely the prices are going to go up. So I think that generally speaking, we're going to see commodities picking up from where they are, not all of them at the same time. And that is going to create an environment which will be good for mining companies. That's what I believe.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much, Cedric. Alan, do you have any final thoughts?
No, just to say, I think it's your timing on these copper projects is it couldn't be better. And just to echo Mark's sentiments, you know, actually getting hold of a piece of real estate on the Galahorry Copper Belt right now, that's a bit of a coup for the company. So well done there.
Well, thank you very much, Cedric, for your time today. Thank you, Alan, for joining us as well. And we'll be keeping a good eye on Altona and looking forward to lots of news flow to come. But thank you very much, Cedric, for your time.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Alan. And I look forward to being in touch soon.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings. Tune in next time.